BCG believes that creating climate solutions is the defining challenge of our generation. So we're working with leaders everywhere to understand and mitigate the cost of climate inaction. But we're also helping them find ways to innovate, build sustainable businesses, and stay competitive in an evolving world. Stick around to discover the many opportunities in a more sustainable global economy.
Welcome to Zero. I am Akshat Rathi. This week, blame, burden, and diplomacy. John Kerry is the Forrest Gump of climate, the guy you'll find at every important turn in history doing something impactful. In 1970, he was in the streets during the first Earth Day protests. In 1992, he was at the Rio Earth Summit that created the COP meetings as we know them. And in 2016, as the US Secretary of State, he signed the Paris Agreement with his granddaughter in his arms. But it is the last 3 years, between the ages of 77 and 80, that he has been fully dedicated to working on the climate issue. And boy, what a time to get going. In 2021, soon after he was sworn in, President Joe Biden created a new office for Kerry as the Special Presidential Envoy on Climate. And his first task was to find a way to repair America's global standing in the climate fight. That, of course, followed a four-year absence during the time when former President Donald Trump decided to pull the US out of the Paris Agreement and regressed on environmental policies. The US can be rightly blamed for being the country that has put the most amount of greenhouse gas emissions cumulatively into the atmosphere. Even though China emits more each year today, it is the historical total that is responsible for global warming and driving extreme weather events. Thus, the US should carry the biggest burden in the climate fight, but it rarely does. Trump's moves only made matters worse. That's why getting the US back on track required Biden to create two teams, one that got working on national climate policies and another one under Kerry that began the delicate work of international diplomacy. 3 years on, Kerry has decided to step away from the post of climate envoy. I got a chance to sit down with him in Paris on the sidelines of the 50th anniversary meeting of the International Energy Agency. I asked him about whether he succeeded at restoring US's global credibility, the difficulties of making progress in multilateral diplomacy, and what still keeps him up at night. Welcome to the show, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Now, let me just start by acknowledging something important. There are few people, if any, who have had such a long arc in the environment and climate world. As a citizen, you were on the very first day of Earth Day in 1970 among the protesters on the streets. As a senator, you were there for the pivotal Senate hearing where climate scientist Jim Hansen spoke clearly than ever before about the coming dangers of climate change in 1988. You were there, of course, at the 1992 Rio Earth Summit that led to the creation of the conventions that give us the COP meetings as they exist. And you were there with your granddaughter signing the Paris Agreement in 2016. And of course, your most recent role as the Special Envoy on Climate for the US, you got the US and the EU together at COP26 in 2021. To focus on reducing methane emissions. Now, just reflecting on that long journey, what would be two or three other memorable moments that I did not list?
You didn't list my mother drafting me when I was in elementary school and took me out to early morning bird walk. And she created a nature path. And she was a great activist. She actually, years later, founded a recycling program in the town in which she lived. And she loved Victory Gardens and things like that. So I was very blessed to have terrific input and a family that cared enormously about the environment.
Now, you said that one of your greatest fears is that the world may not pick up the pace of reducing emissions and slowing down climate change. that people will continue on business as usual. If I were to pick a moment in history, the 1988 Senate hearing, when it seemed both Republicans and Democrats were in agreement that climate change is something that must be tackled. Knowing what you know today, what would you tell your 45-year-old self then that would have helped the world move faster on tackling climate change?
I don't think it's a question of what I would have told people. I think it's more a question of what evidence did we have to make the argument, to be able to persuade people. And I think, obviously, we just didn't have enough at that point in time. It was new. It was scary. It was big. It was a little out of proportion to the things that most people were wrestling with in the Senate. And some people just shrugged their shoulders and said, you know, that's somewhere way down the road in the future. I'm not going to worry about that today. And that has characterized a great deal of the years of the climate crisis, of it growing. And indifference, greed, business as usual, a sense of lack of adequate input and evidence, human nature. I mean, a whole bunch of things have combined in a terrible sort of conspiracy of just realities to prevent people from being as forward-leaning as early as we needed to be. So we're facing grave consequences now, and that's really what we're trying to convince people of is, look, we can solve the problem. We have the knowledge of what we have to do. We even have enough technologies to get to 2030, but we can get to that date and fulfill our obligation to reduce emissions by a minimum of 43%. We can do that. But not everyone is choosing to do that. So we have a political challenge here and one of organizing a great part of the world to act responsibly.
It is the first time that all countries have agreed to set recommendations that could, in principle, keep us on track to meet Paris goals, especially the 1.5 degree Celsius goal. The question is that to do any of it will require trillions of dollars to move many times from developed countries to developing countries. And that's no longer a crazy thing to think about. Last year, global investment in energy transition was $1.8 trillion. So we're already talking in the trillions now. But the biggest gap does remain in developing countries. Those are the places that are not getting the investments that are needed. The power of the US as the largest shareholder of World Bank, for example, can make that happen. There is a conversation right now around reforming the multilateral development banks to be unlocking these trillions of dollars needed for the climate transition. What do you think is needed today, exactly today, to make it happen?
Well, let me, if I may, respectfully correct one thing you said, which is it's not a question of not being able to do any of it. We can do a lot of it. We just can't guarantee that we're going to get to the goal of net zero 2050 and of the production we need by 2030. Because if we don't get it by 2030, there is no net zero 2050. But we can do a lot of things, and we are doing a lot of things. It's just not big enough. It's not enough. It has to come to scale, and it has to happen faster. But there are clearly steps being taken now and have been sort of building up to develop new technologies, to deploy many of those new technologies. We need to have better storage. We need to have green hydrogen. We need better electrolyzers. We need to be able to hopefully win the battle of a new energy production called fusion. We have to be able to get more solar and more wind deployed much faster. We have to apply AI to this. I mean, there are just a whole bunch of things. These ready tools are just staring us in the face. And unfortunately, no country has enough money to automatically implement every part of this. We've got to pick the priorities, I guess, and move as rapidly as we can. But I feel greater optimism now, partly as a result of COP28 in Dubai, but partly as a result of what people are doing all over the world. We have many new initiatives that have come out of our work, I'm proud to say, out of the Special Presidential Envoy's office that was created We've got initiatives that are bringing companies to the table and it accelerating their ability to take hard to abate sectors of the economy like shipping or aviation or cement or steel, et cetera. And they're addressing those things. We also have very significant reduction in the price of solar and wind. It's almost free in a sense. And we need to deploy solar and wind much more rapidly. So I think we're on the cusp of just a major economic transformation where the economies of the world are all going to be moving into a new economic model, which will be a clean energy economy based on these new technologies. So I'm excited by that. And I think that the key for all of us now is to accelerate and scale up. Those are the two biggest things.
Many of the examples that you brought up required government initiative. Mm-hmm. So,
and money.
And First Movers Coalition, which you were hinting at, where you brought companies together to purchase green steel or green cement, that's going to have an impact because that'll bring these companies along.
Well, it sends a signal to the marketplace. And the marketplace says, oh, wow, they're making green steel. We may pay slightly more for it right now, but that's going to advantage the world because it helps us meet our goal.
In the same way, when we are looking at trying to get multilateral development banks reformed so that they can provide that accelerant, you don't need them to provide all the trillions. You need them to provide just the enough amount, hundreds of billions maybe, to accelerate the transition. What do you think your role as the U.S. or what government role can be played to enable that reform to actually happen?
We have made some of that reform happen. President Biden undertook to create change at the World Bank. We have a new leader at the World Bank now. In addition to that, we have rules changes that came in with the fall meeting and spring meeting of the World Bank last year, so that now there's a bigger pot of money available to act as catalytic lending money. So that money can generate even more investment from the private sector, which is exactly its purpose, and that's what we want it to do. I think that there are other finance mechanisms we've been working on. And the reason we're working on the finance is that the UN finance report and other economic analyses have all agreed that in order to win the battle, which is what we ought to be doing, let's do what we need to do to win the battle. That means we have to be investing something like $2.5 to $5 trillion a year for the next 30 years. And we're now at about $1.8 trillion, as I think you mentioned. The key now is to find different ways to catalyze, to attract private capital to the table. Why? Because the private capital can make money. People will be attracted to that marketplace. The truth is that in the U.S., the clean energy jobs in the last year outpaced other energy jobs. So this is a job creator. This is a really exciting economic transformation, bigger than anything that's happened economically in the world since the Industrial Revolution. And I think this will be an even bigger impact economically on all of our countries.
Going back to the point around COP28, if you look at the conversation around climate action, people often criticize the COP. The global diplomacy framework gets dinged for not being able to act fast enough for what is an urgent problem. The Paris Agreement took 20 years back and forth to get to that point. If you ask people, what should we do as a global community to solve the problem? They come to some solution of a form that looks like a COP. But if you were to reform COPs to become better fit for the challenge we face today, what would you do?
Well, I think, in fairness to the COP process, and I'm not here to, say it's perfect, but it represents the hardest form of diplomacy there is, multilateralism. It's a supercharged multilateralism. This isn't 10 nations. This isn't G7. It's not even G20. It's about 195 countries globally, and you have to find consensus. Now, some people say, well, maybe we shouldn't find consensus. Maybe we ought to have a system where we have votes. And you have a vote and majority wins or supermajority wins. The problem with that is that you will wind up with some nations that feel hugely aggrieved at some point in time where everybody just runs over their desires and votes, and they go home completely disgruntled, and you don't have a unified effort to do whatever it is you're trying to do. So it's a mixed blessing. But I think for this kind of effort, the multilateralism that has kind of worked in the last years anyway, no country stood up and said, we're going to crash this thing in Dubai. Didn't happen. People left with a consensus. And that consensus creates greater impetus. It really pushes the system forward. And it makes it harder for some other countries to ignore what everybody else is doing. So I'm not sure, you know, you could pick a thing here or two in the process, but by and large, that was a pretty damn good meeting that took place in Dubai. And the results of it speak for themselves.
So let me ask you the question on the other side, which is COP28, we shall see if it makes an impact. But what is undeniable is that COP21, the Paris Agreement, has made an impact.
For sure. Paris was a huge step forward. I was privileged to lead our delegation's negotiating team in Paris and spent the full 2 weeks or whatever there during that time when I was secretary. But what we achieved building on Paris is may be more significant. I'm not saying is, because right now it's words on a piece of paper. It has to be implemented. That is the key. And what we need to do is make sure that we are really following up, which is what our team is going to do and I'm going to do. I'm going to continue to work on the climate issue, not going to run away from it. And I believe we can bring more private sector people to the table and we can accelerate what we're doing. So if we can do that out of COP28, that'll be a huge success, one of the most important COPs. So let me, if I may, say a word about why is COP28 in Dubai so important. It's important because it created a consensus around the following words. We have to transition away from fossil fuel in a way that is fair, just, equitable, and accelerating in this decade, so as to achieve net zero 2050, according to the science. Those extra words are really critical. According to the science means 1.5 degrees, that's your North Star. And net zero 2050 means you got to have a plan. You got to show people how you're going to get there. And accelerating in this decade is really critical because there are a whole bunch of folks who have sort of way out there goals that won't accelerate in this decade. And the only way we get there is to accelerate in this decade. That's the importance of this COP. It's created a framework that could actually change behavior and greatly accelerate our efforts. It depends on the goodwill, good faith, good sense of countries to really now put their shoulder to the wheel and make it happen.
It is very important to recognize that those order of words, those extra words, matter because they've been signed off by all 195 countries.
Well, they also have particular meaning to getting the job done.
Of course. And so when you think about the Paris Agreement, just reflecting on the strength that it is, that it allowed the countries to be able to progress, what are things you think people don't appreciate about the Paris Agreement that you in your everyday job take for granted?
Well, I mean, I think if you went out and asked the average person in the street anywhere and say, what do you think of the Paris Agreement? They say, what? Is that for the Eiffel Tower? Or is that about the Seine River? Or what is that about? It's more the activists and the government officials and a lot of private sector now who are following very closely what's happening. But the average person, you know, they follow the flood and they follow the tornado and they see what's happening in the weather dramatically because of what's happening with the crisis. But, you know, you're not going to expect them to know the details of that kind of an agreement.
And so as climate solutions start getting more and more closer to people's lives, more and more about the decisions they make on a daily basis, what do they eat, what do they drive, where they travel, is it important that people who understand the Paris Agreement, who understand this world, make that point understood to the lay audience so that the social license for climate action is available?
Everybody who is an activist on the climate issue needs to be even more active. They need to communicate regularly. They need to be pushing candidates or pushing resolutions or running for office. It takes an activism to do what we have to do here. And we need a lot more activists.
More from the conversation after the break.
Today's leaders face many hard choices, confronted with uncertainty, cost pressures, and growing shareholder demands. But they don't have to choose between pursuing climate and business goals. In fact, BCG research suggests that these ambitions go hand in hand. Did you know at least 40% of executives at large organizations estimate an annual financial benefit of $100 million for meeting emissions reduction targets, according to recent BCG research? BCG also found that transitioning to the circular economy could help unlock $4.5 trillion of GDP growth by 2030. The cost of inaction, however, is profound. In fact, further analysis indicates that missing climate targets could result in an average annual EBITDA reduction of 15%. At BCG, our experts recognize the myriad benefits, from risk mitigation to first mover advantage, that come with sustainability. Let's partner to unlock a better sustainability journey.
Now, one reason why what you say makes such a difference is because you represent the world's largest economy. Another reason is that it's also the country that has contributed the most in adding to the greenhouse gas load causing the problem. Going back to the 1992 Rio Earth Summit, it enshrined the idea of common but differentiated responsibilities, which basically says those with greater means should do more to address the problem. And the US is the country with the greatest means. But you also bristle at the idea that doing more should just mean cold, hard government cash, which analysis after analysis shows that the US hasn't quite contributed as much as it should. So if not cash, one place you say that the US has made a fundamental contribution is around technology development. Do you think just those two things are enough for what the US must do to match up to its responsibility behind the cumulative emissions that it has put out?
Absolutely not. No, I do not believe that that is enough, nor is that what we have allowed to be enough, because we've been the ones pushing a whole bunch of other initiatives. And unknown to a lot of people, while a particular program of climate may not have been as fully funded as something else or someone else chose to be, we are the largest humanitarian donor in the world. We hit the 100 billion that had been promised in Paris, and everybody was contentious about why isn't that hit? Why isn't that hit? It turns out it was hit and met in 2022. It was met last year in 23, and that's partly because we put up more money, but we also worked with other countries to bring more to the table. So I think we've had a very positive impact in that way. President Biden has put forward an emergency plan for dealing with adaptation. And in that plan, he's promised $12 billion in order to help make that happen. He's put down payments down each year now in the budget. And what we chose to do was address America's absence from the prior 4 years. So we approached it with humility because we needed to be humble. Having not contributed money or been involved for those 4 years, we knew we had to earn our credibility and work our way back. We worked hard at doing that. President Biden rejoined the agreement the afternoon within a couple hours of being sworn in as president. And we began the process of moving around the world doing climate diplomacy to raise other countries' ambition to get people to put in a new national determined contribution, so-called NDC. And people did. And so we held a summit in the East Room of the White House, virtually. President Xi took part. President Putin took part. It was before Ukraine and other tensions. But we got people to commit during that, to raise their ambition for Glasgow and then raise their ambition for Sharm el-Sheikh. And ultimately, we really succeeded in pulling people to a whole bunch of initiatives that made a difference. We started an agriculture initiative to help farmers and other people be able to deal with new forms of agriculture or ways in which they could deal with methane or other challenges. We created the methane pledge. We started with about 20 countries. Now we have 155 nations have signed on to this, and there's major attention on methane. We also put out a pledge to triple the deployment of nuclear and to double energy efficiency, which is one of the best ways you can reduce costs and so forth. We have a maritime shipping initiative, which is now seeing ships building a carbon-free propulsion on those ships. So there's so many places where I think our initiative has helped, and I say that not with any arrogance or anything, but with pride, with a sense also that that's making a difference. We really did change the way everybody is engaging in this by raising ambition and starting these initiatives.
Absolutely. And let me just pick methane emissions, because the pledge started with only 20 countries. It wasn't part of the main negotiated document in Glasgow. Right. And of course, that hasn't stopped it from being effective and growing in size. So there is clearly ways in which even outside of these big, thick channels of diplomacy that you can make stuff happen. But you're also going to be moving on from this job, staying in climate, doing other things. It would be remiss to not ask about your frustrations in this role. What stopped you from doing more, or what were things that you wanted but you couldn't achieve that you would hope your successor?
I would have loved to have been able to invest more funding in the transition to help people have a just, fair, equitable transition. So you have to be able to try to get some focus on poor or disenfranchised communities. I would have liked to have seen us be able to help some of those communities more than we've been able to, even though we have upped the amount of assistance that they're getting and the focus that they're getting. I wish we could have gotten Congress more enlisted in this so that we were really putting some of the federal money on the table that we need to be able to attract more private sector money. You have to de-risk some of these deals out there. But all in all, I don't look at, I honestly don't think that there are that many regrets by us, except for the speed and size of what we all wish we were doing. All the programs we tried to put in place are in place. They are working. They are making a difference.
Now, last question, one big picture question. You've said the thing that is slowing progress down is political will. Now, if you go back to 1970, to that Earth Day, and you look over the lifetime of looking at environmental issues, climate issues, as Secretary of State traveling around the world, do you think there is now enough political will, or much more than we had in the past, that this thing is something that people will remain focused on and address, if not to the perfect level, but at least go much, much closer to the goals?
Well, there's not enough. There's much more. And no question, there's much more. And there could be more, and there needs to be even more. But what we do know is that what we have been able to achieve has really moved the ball very significantly. I mean, if you listen to the IEA, where we are today as we're having this conversation, the IEA has helped to change the playing field and has helped us to have a referee who can kind of step in and say, hey, wait a minute, you got to do this, or you got to do that, or here's what's happening. And they've been really good on the science, really good on helping people to understand the reality of why we have to move even more. So there are a lot of partnerships that have come out of this. The IEA and U.S. Envoy's Office is one of them. But we've also built much stronger relationships with a lot of our fellow ministers in Germany and France and Norway and UK, around the world. That's been really satisfying. Now, you raised the question, you know, why not more? Why aren't we kind of getting it done? We face basic human behavior as a challenge in this. First of all, it's a big issue, hard to get your arms around it and grasp it if you're just living everyday life and don't deal with it all the time. And in addition, there's some bad actors. We are fighting disinformation. We're fighting exploitation. People who scare people and say, oh my God, you know, look at these guys. They want to tell you what kind of car you have to drive. They want to force you into an untenable, you know, job or whatever. No, no, and no, and no. We're not trying to do anything like that. We want people to choose whatever it is they want. But we want them to have the ability to have a wise choice staring them in the face. And that means that you've got to have the opportunities to have clean power. You've got to have good long-distance travel and batteries for electric vehicles, and you've got to do more to sort of make that happen, and we are. So I really think that we've got a template. We know what we have to do, but human nature is a challenge at times, and people are scared sometimes when they hear from somebody, oh, you know, if you do that, you're not going to be able to get to work, or, you know, your energy will be shut off or something. There's just an awful lot of outright lying. And there's sort of a selfish greed that does motivate some people who are in places where they can have an impact. And so that's one of the things we have to fight and fight back against.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you for listening to Zero. If you like this episode, please take a moment to rate or review the show on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Share this episode with a friend or with someone who liked Forrest Gump. You can get in touch at zeropod@bloomberg.net. Zero's producers are Tiffany Choi, Magnus Henriksen, and Somer Sadi. Our theme music is composed by Wonderly. Special thanks to Kira Bindrim and Jen DeLui. I am Akshat Rathi, back soon.